accession number 21564, reel 7.
Colonel Cormac, reel 7. You were saying that the Chinese artillery was very effective and that therefore you had to build special...
Robust. Mm. I mean, in the early days, you either dug your own trenches and gave each other mutual support in the time-honoured way. Battalion headquarters and company headquarters tended to have a little bit of overhead cover. But as you were... the battle was more fluid, you didn't stay there very long. And quite often we also inherited Chinese positions, which had communicating trenches, and you just tarted those up, and you would help, particularly with wire fences. We did a lot of wiring for the infantry, in addition to their own. But the bunker, overhead cover, became, as the campaign settled down, became more important. And we started off with timber overhead cover, but in certain cases, particularly like the Hook, although this is not my personal experience, we changed from timber overhead cover to prefabricated concrete beams, which would give slightly better protection for longer. So that was how things developed. Wiring for fuel defences also developed. We used to put up a double apron standard wire fences round. When the wire was tensioned and staked down and properly, and then we used to have concertina fences. But the double apron fence suffered from the disadvantage that if it was hit by mortar artillery fire and the wire was cut, it sprang apart, and then you were left with great gaps in your wire. So more and more we looked at concertina, and that was quite effective, but quite difficult to lay in depth. So what we used to do was to improvise and expand on the low wire entanglement, which was just a mess of wire strung out in different directions, but also at different heights. The original low wire entanglement was about 18 inches, possibly 2 feet high, so that you couldn't actually run across it safely. But we found that by getting that area and filling it in with loose wire, it didn't matter how many times it was shelled or mortared, the wire lifted up and then sprang, then collapsed back again into an even nastier tangle than before. So those ideas on wiring for defence positions, you know, modified and elaborated on as the campaign went on.
Presumably, if you're using wire in the concertina form, you need more of it than if you're laying something like a double apron. Is it more expensive than wire?
It was heavy to carry up the things. So we had to reel them out.
Yes.
It was expanding.
Yes.
And it would depend so much on the supply of wire that you had.
Yes.
The Americans all used to go for these spools with the wire wrapped around it, which you reeled off, which was ideal for doing our minefield fences. Mm. The concertina fences, I think, were probably in more short supply, although they would have been themselves ideal for filling in, and you could pile them on top of each other as in the time-honoured way to increase the height of the obstacle. Mm. But we used to just improvise at that level and also have two or three strands at eye level, which were particularly effective at night because you could see the low wire entanglement, but you might not notice the strands at eye, chest or neck level. And if you came and took a chance to run through, you would be quickly brought up by that sort of strand. That was the idea. Well, we weren't very nice people, but then that wasn't a nice situation.
Did you have to use improvised obstacles as well as using formal wire defences?
Yes, we used to use natural materials that were spiky. You could use timber spikes, but they were difficult to construct. But there was a lot of undergrowth that was brambly and prickly and difficult to get through, particularly when it dried out.
Yes.
And that would cause great discomfort, tearing and scratching, in combined with other things. And then you might, if you did that, string your grenade strands through the middle when they were struggling through that.
They'd be letting off the grenades.
And they could, that would be an addition like that. Mm. Yes, there were various improvisations like that. And they were also difficult to make it difficult to approach positions because of the noise element.
Yes.
And we also strung tins up with pebbles in them, which would rattle and give warnings, as well as the periodic tripwire flares that we use, but they were again occasionally in short supply, so you backed it up with other things to give warning, slow them down, make it difficult for them in every way you could.
You mentioned taking over and using Chinese positions. What was the sort of quality of their field defences?
Very good. They were very good at digging. They dug very fast and very effectively. And they tended to be, I say, positions with communicating trenches and then buried into the hill. Mm. And they, in fact, were way ahead of us when it came to tunnelling and building it in bunkers inside. They were very good at concealing artillery positions on hillsides. They would have the gun buried inside the hill with possibly a Hessian sheet or something covering the entrance, push the gun forward to an absolutely pre-arranged position, fire off their rounds, pull it back and drop it down before the gunner OPs and FOOs could actually spot where they were. The most effective antidote to that was the use of the Centurion tank and the 17-pounder anti-tank guns, which were very rarely used in that role. They were flat trajectory weapons, and you could have them, and we spent a lot of time helping tanks get up into positions like that, and they were trained virtually on the place we suspected these might be, and they could react very quickly with direct flat trajectory fire.
So they'd spot the flash and then retaliate immediately. Yeah. Does this mean then that you also had to prepare hides for tanks and anti-tank weapons? Was that part
not
of
so
it?
Much hides as make it easier for them to get up to the top of a hill.
Yes.
And then they could back down again to a sort of below the crest, as it were. And also make sure that we could supply them with the ammunition. And we invented or designed sledge trailers that they could haul up with more stuff than the porters could carry in a short time, that sort of thing, and make it easy for them to get up and move to other fire positions. But the Chinese, apart from artillery, they didn't have much in the way of anti-tank weapons that I could recall.
The tanks were reasonably invulnerable once they were...
Yeah, they were fairly safe. I mean, heavy artillery fire can damage them, obviously, but they survived quite well.
And you're talking about how our bunkers had to be improved because the Chinese artillery fire became more powerful. What sort of thickness of overhead cover would you normally put on a bunker?
18 inches, but that would have been doubled or trebled out there. Mm. Yes.
Would this be wood or wood and earth? Or
it was originally wood and earth, and then when we could, prefabricated concrete beams that we used.
Mm. I mean, did you give overhead cover to fighting positions as well as to shelter positions?
Where possible, on things, features like the hook and other key positions, yes. Mm. But by and large, people felt a bit happier if they could get out of their trenches with their weapons. So you had to balance out the morale factor of being in a bunker that could have collapsed on you if heavily hit by fire, and the safety of and the flexibility of being able to move your weapons from one position to another quickly and improve or alter your arc of fire.
Did you ever actually dig continuous lines of entrenchment?
No, we never did. The only ones we used were the ones we inherited from the Chinese and the odd position like that.
So you were digging what? Would the standard infantry position be a two-man rifle?
Two-man trench,
pit?
Yes. Occasionally three-man. The Americans were much inclined to the foxhole trench, one man, one thing. But they came round to our way of thinking later, and they had the buddy system, which was our two-man trench. And if you had time, then you would have overhead cover at the end,
yes,
that someone who was standing down could go and get a bit of kip.
Yeah.
But by and large, we didn't do that. We just had the trenches. Mm. What we did have were little shells cut in where you could have your boxes of grenades already handy to pull out, already armed and clean to throw down. Mm. There were modifications like that. Mortar positions, they tended to dig themselves. Machine gun positions, they dug themselves, or with assault pioneer help. You know, it was In fact, we would do anything we were asked to do, but those were the main things. Explosive came into it a bit, because again, when it got settled down and the Chinese positions were more carefully marked, and we would send raiding parties to blow up bunkers and tunnels, and techniques were devised to put in charges quickly and set them off so that the blast would just blow out the whole bunker instead of just firing out the hole at the entrance, as it might have done. And a few raiding parties did that sort of thing.
When that sort of raid went on, did the sappers go off with the infantry?
Yes, they would provide cover.
Yes.
Every patrol that went out had an infantry commander, regardless of the rank of the sapper involved. When it came to the actual sapper bit, then he would take over. But the route in, route out, the orders for quiet, stop, were all given by the infantry patrol commander, who could be a corporal or sergeant or whatever. And that worked out. We understood that, and they understood our job. It was
presumably, if you were, did you ever have to borrow infantry to get additional manpower to carry out your tasks?
No. Now, we had enough Korean labourers to do all the sort of extra digging or extra work that we wanted, yes. Mm. In that respect, you see, our ordinary section sappers became quite used to having a section of road of perhaps 200 or 300 yards long. They would be responsible for all the work that went on there with Korean labourers. So young sappers, or youngish sappers, no rank, became accustomed to telling people what to do and managing a task themselves. That was quite an interesting aspect of it, and some of them developed quite well that way.
Good training for future NCOs.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Mm. That's right.
And you mentioned also that you had to do infantry work. What sort of infantry operation did you carry out?
Mostly occupying a platoon position to help a company or battalion position to thicken up. That in the ground they had to cover, and the frontages were usually quite extensive, perhaps more than we would have liked under those circumstances, that if things got a bit serious, we would be invited to go and support one of the battalions. I did all of them, I think, and build or occupy a platoon position and develop it with our own fire pits, our fire positions, our own wire, and so on. And yes, we did that quite a lot. And that's when I SOP, sergeant rank, and off we go, and up in the hills.
How long would you be in the line if you were having to hold a...
Usually a few days position at the most. Mm.
What was the sort of routine day if you were holding a defensive position?
Well, we followed the battalion standing orders, whatever they were. We just followed suit, and the company commander and the battalion commander, if necessary, would brief us accordingly, and they would check that our positions were properly done. And when they stood to, we stood to, and so on in the morning and the evening.
Did you take part in any large-scale offensive operations in the infantry role?
No. I can say that we were mostly involved in a defensive role, and to thicken up or add depth to a defence where necessary. An interesting factor is that when we started off, we were equipped as a sapper troop with 3 Bren guns, 1 2-inch mortar, and everyone had a rifle, or section commanders, the dreadfully inefficient Sten gun, and a few grenades. By the time we had been in a defensive role a couple of times, I suddenly found that we had acquired 6 Bren guns, 3 2-inch mortars, and a Browning 300 machine gun, all of which we had acquired from material left lying around in the battlefield. And I suspect that most infantry rifle platoons, certainly the KSLI was involved with one thing after Op Commando, had doubled up and sometimes trebled up on the number of automatic weapons to give themselves the firepower to deal with the sheer numbers that were likely to come at them. But that was my personal experience. From 3 to 6 Bren guns, 3 2-inch mortars, and a Browning 300. Plenty of ammunition was available from unofficial sources lying around.
So there was a little parallel illegal logistics system running alongside there.
It wasn't just illegal. It was just that was the way things were. Mm. You didn't leave anything lying around that was useful. Mm. If you could pick it up and use it, you did.
Mm. Were you subjected to any large-scale attacks while you were in the infantry role?
No, I can't say that we were. It was all sort of routine probing, nothing more than that.
Mm.
It would be nice to be dramatic, but no, I don't think... I would like to think that our mere presence there deterred them, but perhaps that's not the case.
Mm.
No, it was just routine. We didn't know what was going to happen. We couldn't anticipate, but no large-scale attack that came our way.
Mm. What about getting involved in forward movement? Were you involved in any large-scale movements forward on our side?
That was the best time that we had was a thing called Operation Commando. We had, as I mentioned before, been mostly stationed or set up behind on the south side of the River Imjin.
Yes.
There had been patrols across, some in strength, and it was felt that we could, A, show our positive merit as a Commonwealth Division, and also straighten up the line and do that sort of thing. And so Op Commander was started, and I took half a troop, and I was still using the Bren gun carriers then, and attached to our squadron, that's A, our squadron of the King's Own Royal Irish Hussars, the 8th Hussars. And we were, in particular, supporting the KSLI at that time. And our job was to be with them and undertake any sapper tasks that might come along, like clearing mines and booby traps, any doubtful things, and immediately helping with mobility. And that would range from sorting out a Centurion tank that had slipped off its tracks, because although each tank had its own track demolition kit, they were not always able or willing to use those. So we did quite a lot of blowing tracks, laying them out, driving the tank onto it or getting it driven onto it, and then helping them to link up an extra link for the tank to carry on its mobile role, that sort of thing. And we were up with the tanks and the infantry right the way through to the time they captured their objectives. That was mobile, and it involved quite a bit of forward movement, several miles, and that was, I think, perhaps one of the last really big offensive moves the Commonwealth Division did.
This sounds like a sort of miniature battle group, the Shropshires.
It was, yes.
Had you worked together with these two units before? Were you accustomed to
working
alongside
them? No, I hadn't.
Them?
No, I was simply sent out with the brief to go and make myself as useful as possible to the 8th Hussars and their squadron commander, a very distinguished Admiral Pat de Clermont, and then the KSLI under Battling Bill Barlow, as we used to call him. It was D Company that I was with mostly, Jimmy Cottle, who got a DSO for that operation, and some of his platoon commanders, like Tishy Borick, were contemporaries of mine at Sandhurst.
Mm.
So we fitted in very well from that point of view, which it was good. And so they knew me, and that I wasn't entirely stupid, and we got on very well, and really worked quite as a team.
How were the KSLI mounted in vehicles, or were they on foot for the...
They were on foot for that, yes.
How was this operation actually conducted? What happened?
Well, we all formed up in the usual FUP, and that was where I think I first came under serious artillery fire.
Mm.
Whether the Chinese suspected or not, or whether it was a routine thing, but I was with a troop of the 8th Hussars of our squadron, and we were dotted around, ready to go with them when we were shelled. And of course, that was the first time that I thought of sheltering underneath a Centurion tank, as opposed to digging a trench or whatever. It seemed more economical of effort. That was an operation fraught with danger if you didn't choose your ground carefully, because in later episodes, one or two were crushed to death when a tank sank into the mud during the night. But that's by the way, that's who we're with. So we came under fire, then we moved forward, followed with the tanks. My half section came behind, and I rode with the troop commander on the turret. And then, as things happened, we reacted and dismounted, helped them when we could, looked around for booby traps, make sure that the position they had captured was clear, and that was the sort of thing.
Where were the infantry? Were the infantry behind
the tanks? They were forward.
Forward.
Yeah.
How far forward of the leading tanks were the leading infantry?
Not very far. It's a matter of a few hundred yards, if that. Yes. Just it was in range for close tank support if that was required, and so that we would be able to react to clear positions if anything was required in that direction.
What sort of pace did this attack go? Was it walking pace?
Yes, walking pace. Mm. Yeah, we didn't go at any speed.
What sort of a formation were the infantry in ahead of you?
It was difficult to judge. From what I could see, it was a, you know, it's very definitely the worm's eye view in that case.
Yes.
But the platoons seemed to act on different minor objectives in relation to what Jimmy Cottle had been told to do on the main thing. And having attended the O group, that's roughly what I expected. There was a certain amount of independence within the overall plan. Mm. And it worked. They cleared through and the Chinese melted away after sort of firefights.
Did you have effective artillery support?
Oh, very.
Mm. What sort of support it was it?
It was enormous support from 25-pounders mainly. Mm. And one has a memory now of an incredible amount of 25-pounder shell mostly coming down the Chinese positions.
Mm. Was this timed concentrations, or was it on call, or was it a creeping barrage? What sort of fire
Just to
support?
Think carefully there. It really was on the positions. It wasn't a creeping barrage, no.
So it's suppressive bombardment.
That's right. That was a bit. Mm. It was definitely keeping their heads down and causing as much damage while we came up.
Mm. And how was that control? Where was the FOO? Was he?
Oh, he was with the infantry. Mm. Without a doubt, he was up there with the infantry.
Did you get any air support?
I don't recall any at that time. There must have been, but I personally don't recall any. Mm. We did get on many minor operations a lot of good air support. Mm. And I formed an impression, again, I have to say an impression, that the best air support we had came from the Fleet Air Arm. Yeah. The carrier-based planes not far away out in the west side of the Korean Peninsula. There were no RAF. The South African and Australian Air Forces were good, but they weren't always able to support us. I would say that the American Air Force were not as good. I wouldn't criticise them unduly, but they were not as effective as our own support from the Fleet Air Arm.
In what way? Were they less accurate or less...
Less accurate. Mm. They seemed to be more hidebound. If that's what we are told to do, we are told we do it, regardless of any common sense approach. Because in those days, after the... Oh, and including the great disaster with the Argyles when Kenneth Muir got his VC, we had these air recognition panels.
Yes.
Which were fluorescent strips of red and yellow and blue, which were laid out in various shapes that anyone could identify. Mm. But if my impression was that if an American pilot got a grid reference to hit in close support, then regardless of what he saw on the ground, he would say, they've made a mistake, I hit that, because that's what I've been told to do. Mm. Now, that may be being slightly unfair, but that's an impression I got. Mm. Because with these panels, which were quite big, it should not have been possible for them to attack their own positions.
Mm. On this advance, how long did this operation take, Operation Commando?
Only a few days. Mm. I don't have a clear memory of exactly how long it took.
What was the ground like over which you were advancing for that?
It had been fought over, but not seriously fought over before, because I remember plenty of trees and undergrowth which, on those hills which had been fought over repeatedly, tended to be rather bare. Mm. That, as an afterthought, made it very difficult when we went back some years later to recognize features, because the Koreans had instituted a tree planting program, a National Arbor Day, that sort of thing, and the hills that we knew as being stripped bare of, chopped down by bombs, shells, mortars, of trees and shrub were all covered with trees again. That did make it quite difficult to say I was there. So that's the point. At that time, they were not blasted to bits. And so I remember a fat amount of cover and undergrowth and tree life around.
How were the tanks deployed? Were they in line ahead on the road, or were they
loosely?
Loose.
They were in by troops, two tanks supporting each other. Never less than three that I can remember operating. But that was, again, from a worm's eye view. I was just concerned with the minutiae of the battle. It's I don't want to be too influenced about what I've read since.
Yeah. What did your sappers actually do then? You mentioned how they could help to put a track back on a damaged Centurion.
And sort out a clearer position of potential booby traps, that sort of thing, and moving obstacles that would hinder tank movement, but generally poised to be of use where we could.
Were they called forward at all to assist the infantry in clearing?
No, not as infantry in that case, no. We were not actually that involved in that. I think that's really what it came down to. It was just exciting, interesting. And I felt we made a worthwhile contribution. So without being specific after all that time, that was the feeling we had. And also the people we were working for used to say nice things about us. That's about it, I think.
Did you capture any Chinese prisoners during this advance?
There were some captured, but I only captured one personally, and that was shortly afterwards. And we were looking forward and looking to clear a road, and I had just a couple of my own sappers with me, and lo and behold, we were just out in the Ulu. Not really on patrol, but we were well ahead of our own people. This chap came ambling down the road. I thought, good God, here are the Chinese. So I dropped into a ditch, had my pistol in my hand, ready to do my damnedest, and leapt out and say whatever you have to say. Like Corporal Jones, hand a hawk or something like that.
Hands up.
I have to say that in all probability the poor chap was so desperately pleased to be captured. It wasn't really a desperate situation. But we did capture him, we took him back and had a chance to examine what he was and how he was dressed and equipped. And I made a souvenir of his rifle, which was a Russian Mousson Nagant with a very nice full-back bayonet, very much superior to ours, with flutes to enable the blood to run away, of course, I was told afterwards. But all you had to do was to flick it up and it was in place. You didn't have to go through any complicated bayonet drill, which the British Army seems to be rather, or was rather prevalent about, and took him back. And he had his a sort of canvas tube round his shoulder full of rice and oatmeal or something like that, mealies or something like that, and that was what he would subsist on. It was late summer, early autumn, a light canvas uniform. His hat was a red star, and quite reasonable lightweight boots.
Was he in good physical condition as far as you could tell?
As far as I could tell, he was thin and wiry, not too big, but I would say yes, he was probably in good condition. It just seemed to me that he had somehow mentally got fed up with the whole thing and was intent on giving himself up. I don't think there's anything dramatic about it, but that was the one time I caught a Chinese soldier.
Did he have any papers or anything of that sort on him?
Yes, he had a little identification tin, which they all had with stamps and seals, which told them who he was and or told whatever. And I gather that was quite useful in identifying which unit of formation he came from.
What was
but that was passed down the line. I didn't see that.